Hey, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to see everybody together. Let us learn Torah. We are learning today on the topic of how Jews read the news. There's a lot to learn about in this particular topic, but let's start at the very beginning. First, I want to take a moment to thank Rosemary and Owen Fish, who are sponsoring today's shiur. This is the Refuah Shlema of Mordechai ben Tzipora Malka, v'kol cholei beis Yisrael, v'ezras Hashem. It should be a Refuah Shlema Bekarov. Thank you very much, Rosemary and Owen, for being part of the shiur. Also, we would like to thank David and Naomi Kasovitz, who are sponsoring for the recent engagement of Alex to Rivka Schlosselberg, Be'ezras Hashem. The wedding should be B'Shah Tov Mitzlachas. What a wonderful, wonderful simcha. God willing, this should be the beginning of many, many more in the family in Gazantim. It's Hashem. What a special occasion. Let us learn for these special moments. Let's learn the beginning. So, before looking at how Jews...
Before you start, I'm trying to connect to the internet. Is there a password for the guest?
Maybe you ask me. I'm just going to get into the general. Before we start the topic of how Jews read the news, I'd like to take a few examples throughout history as to how this works. Specific examples. There really is a question, and that is should Jews be reading the news in the first place? We will address this first, and then do some examples of Jews reading the news in general. So you say, well, what could be wrong about benignly reading the newspaper? So the truth is that this topic actually is addressed in Hilchos Shabbos. Why? Because on Shabbos there is a issur to read what's called Sharei Hedyotos, which means to say bills, financial transactions, things that will lead us to business thoughts, is the concern on Shabbos. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch talks about other things that also may be asur or mutar. So, for instance, the Shulchan Aruch talks about melitzos umeshalim shel sichas chulin. So, all kinds of fables and stories that are perhaps like meaningless discussions. Some of them may be a concern as a gezeira, as an extension of what's called shtarei hedyotos as well. Interestingly enough, there seems to be a general principle that works on Shabbos, and which goes as follows. During the weekday, it would actually be reading business material is actually better than talking about issues of frivolity and meaninglessness. Ironically, on Shabbos, frivolity and meaninglessness is better than business, ironically speaking, in terms of the halachas of the day. So the question becomes, what about newspapers? This is discussed certainly predominantly in the later Achronim because it became more of a predominant thing. And certainly in Europe, when many papers were being produced. I'm sorry, are there any extras floating around? There's over here, Dr. Jaeger. There's something there. It seems to be that many, many papers, certainly Yiddish papers, were going around, and there were many papers of the day. Many of them had a lot of political activity in them. What does one do about these things? These are talked about in various achronim. I'd like to share three different perspectives on that before jumping into perhaps some examples where it's important for us to reframe our thinking. So one example is Rav Feivel Cohen, who has a sefer called the Badei HaShulchan on the Shulchan Aruch. He has on many, many different sections of halacha. On the halachas of Shabbos, he quotes on his footnotes called Ketzos HaShulchan, and this large footnote here. Now, we're not going to do the whole thing, but suffice to say, let's start off seven lines in. He says the following. First, he acknowledges we'll call it the Frum papers, right? So he says, Uvizma Nenu. The first word is Ha'achronim. He says, Uvizma Nenu. In our times, moifiim ktsas itonim b'chol medina u'medina al yedei yishtadlus yirei Hashem, shebohem me'oyririm al inyanei hadas b'chayei atzibur, v'chizuk inyanei acharedim m'shivei milchama shara milchemes Hashem. So he says there are papers which are really fully on topics of Torah and the fight of Torah and issues at hand in the Torah community. V'ein bohem inyanei mekach u'memkar klal. And they don't have a business section. Right, it's not focused on business and trade. It would seem that such newspapers are permissible to read on Shabbos. The Shuvra is, he says, however, I've reconsidered sheishli stapik boz, that perhaps even this might be a concern. Why? Sometimes it's very depressing to read them. Right? Why? Mishmuas loy tova. because there's terrible news all the time. That's what makes news. Heder tzaddik or mitzoras achene beis Israel birach ve'olam. You hear about a Jew is killed in France, and you hear about a tzaddik who passes away. When you start hearing things which relate to the Pew study or anything to do with the situation of religion in our day, that itself is incredibly depressing. You're not supposed to be reading things which are depressing on Shabbos. So not because of the business and not because of the we'll call it the philosophical, theological content, but just because sometimes reading the news is depressing. That's what makes the news. They're not talking about all the happy, contented people living in the world who are living day to day with their neighbors in peace, and that doesn't make news. It's when there's tragedy and carnage, and that's what makes news. So now he says the following. However, but the rest of the newspapers, outside of the scope of what he just described, Rubam Kekulam Yisyatzu Al Hashem, most of them are at best agnostic and usually atheistic, Al Meshicha, and against God's message in this world. And he says, Umaleim Al Kol Gedoysam Mamre Cheshek Veleitzonus. And they are mostly filled with all types of frivolity. Minus. Heresy, kfira, denial of Hashem, rachman litzlan, v'av b'chol asu likrois, samafila misha rotsa likrois, rak hachadosh. So you say, I'm only going to read the news. I'm not going to read the editorials, right, which have all this information in them. He says, you should not do that. Me'a olam shehei mivim gamkein yeshleso dilmo yimshach likrois divrei hacheshek oy haminos, because you're going to end up reading the wrong thing. And it's really full of these, of this. So there is a camp which, and very understandably, says is that most of the newspapers that we read today, there is the business section, which is business, and there is the section of news, but there's another section, and that is what fills up all those 24 pages of this section of the newspaper. They have to fill it up every single day, after all. So they put all kinds of things, and many of those things are not in sync with Judaism and its basic moral understanding, and reading those things is destructive. So that's what the Badei HaShulchan says. And just to swing to the other side of the spectrum, and this may not be at odds with this, but there was a beautiful interview in 2010. One of a chaver of mine, Shaul Seidler-Feder, did an interview of his Rebbe, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tender, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, who just passed away. About a year ago, he was Nifa, unfortunately. And so he, as you are aware of, he was the son-in-law of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He married Rav Moshe Feinstein's daughter. So in this interview, it's a very beautiful interview to read. He describes, this is published in the Kol Mevaser, one of the YU publications, and he says the following. This is very beautiful to read. His mashver, that's Rav Moshe Feinstein, was uniquely sensitive to society. Despite what they write in all the books about him, mashver never failed to read the Yiddish newspaper, either the Tog in the early years or the Moch Zunar. The Morning Journal, later on, cover to cover every single day. People published that he would walk down the street and avert his eyes when he passed the newspaper stands. There are 1,000 Talmidim who will testify, I bought the paper and handed it to him in the lunchroom of the yeshiva. But it does not make a difference for some people, they do not want to hear that. Even when he was not well, and the doctor insisted that he must lie down to sleep sleep for an hour, he would go home, put on a bathrobe, and smuggle a newspaper into the bedroom so that his wife would not see it. He sat there reading the whole time rather than sleeping. I used to ask him, why do you read this chazarai, this junk? He would respond to me, das ist mein Winter. This is my window into the world. He understood society and his Piskei Halacha show that. He used to say that people think that because I'm aware of society, I become a mekil, a lenient decisor. What do they want me to do? To paskin incorrectly? I'm not a mekil. I paskin the way it has to be. The halacha takes into account societal factors. His willingness to be exposed to society made his teshuvas more meaningful and more acceptable. So, if you want to now, right, this is the Yiddish paper. We're not talking about the New York Times. We're certainly not talking about the New York Post. We should probably write an article about me before saying that. But nonetheless, Ramosha had an insistence of being involved in understanding what is going on in the world. And just to clarify, so some people will take out the story as it's important to read the newspaper every day. No. it's important to learn Shas and Poskim like Rav Moshe learned it and read the newspaper every day. So I just want to point that out. This was the end of the reading material of Rav Moshe. Once he'd finished everything else, he had this. But this was in addition to it. He was able to do this. So for him, this was an important piece. And certainly in terms of what was going on in society, he received questions from all walks of life in the most complex of issues, and you need to know what's going on. Sorry?
It doesn't relate to Shabbos.
Right, so this is not specific to Shabbos at all. This is weekday, and that's the main focus, is being aware of the world, reading newspapers as well. So Rav Moshe clearly was involved. The Chofetz Chaim has another perspective, understandably. The Chofetz Chaim is concerned with this practice on two accounts. He has a sefer called Zechor LeMiriam. It's actually something which is applicable this week, because Pashas Ki Seitze, that Zachor is found in this Pasha. Remember what happened to Miriam? What was the concern there?
Lashon Hara,
right? So the Rav Chofetz Chaim wrote many, 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 many Svarim. We know some of the more famous ones, like Chofetz Chaim Shneur Asa Lashon Mishneh Berurah. He wrote many, many, many other Svarim. He wrote a whole Sefer on the Maseches Zvachim. He wrote Torah Sabayis. He wrote many, many Svarim. Zachor LeMiriam, and this he focuses on the 23rd chapter. Take a look in Source 3. We're going to drop down to seven lines. He talks about how one of the inoculations that we can have, the vaccinations for the times of Mashiach, is to focus on learning of Torah. And he says that today it's the opposite. Why? He says, the first one in the line is Ali Beinu. In the middle of the line it says, Vila Mashal. Today it's the opposite. Kriyas Eitonim, reading newspapers. Shinis Rabu Ma'od Bizmanenu. People, it's very popular. And remember, he's talking in the turn of the century, 20th century, in Eastern Europe. Everybody's reading the Yiddish newspapers. There's political activism, Zionism, communism. All those ideas are in the newspapers. This was the tool of reaching the masses. He says, V'rabu Kayom Ma'od Akarim Asam. Many, many people read the newspapers. V'hinei. It's going to take you at least an hour in the day. Now, folks, he didn't even have an app with notifications. He didn't even have some company that wants to get as many clicks as possible every time that somebody breathes in out of their left nostril in New York City. So, who wants our time and attention? But in those days, it would take an hour out of our day. Today it's even worse, because that hour is going to be split up over our day every time there's a notification. So every time we're getting into some sort of important conversation, some important piece of work, bing, and now suddenly that time has evaporated. I wonder what the Chofetz Chaim would say about that. But nonetheless, so let's say you become a very proficient newsreader. So what happens? You become the go-to person. Right? Everybody comes to you and says, so nu vos herzach, and then you go on to repeat in great detail. You're going to go into all the details. You're going to lose even more time. Then there are those who can't just read one newspaper. It's too much. Elakarin shloisho arbaitonim, we call min v'min. So you read all different kinds. Right, mevalin al ze kama shoaz boyam, and you really are completely wasting so much time in the day. Hinei, b'meshach shanos shlema, you start for kol hashoaz alalu v'yale laharbos me'oz shanos shoaz shavru bohem ha'hevel. Barik. So you wasted, like, you now do the cheshbon for the entire year. Work out how many hours that has taken you. And that's a very long amount of time. But kol ze, skipping to the next paragraph, hu rak oidoiz la'bitul Torah v'atzmoyam egiyah mekriyas ha'tan. This is just simply about wasted time. And most of the news, which is exciting, is that which is scintillating. And scintillating usually means arguments, disrepute, and so on. If they didn't write that, we wouldn't read it. That's what makes news. Mm-hmm. We're all going to be asked the question about how we spent our lives. And if our lives were spent only reading newspapers, that's going to be a very hard case to defend. So the Chofetz Chaim is pointing out this is not so much from the angle of the Bar HaShulchan, which is all the heresy, so to speak, but he's just saying it's like, how much is a news cycle once it's passed? Turns out that there are significant events in our lives, and I'm sure we all are aware of them. There are significant watershed moments in history, in American history, in world history, and we know about those. Those are very important. But all the rest, You know, all those little details. If it happens to be that we're invested in the market, let's say, and we're invested in specific financial tools which depend on the news cycles, then there is a great toilet. But a lot of the things, if you think about, can we even remember what we read a week ago as to what the specific details about a particular political equivocation or somebody who slammed another person in a tweet? And it doesn't really matter so much. You know, I guess most of it doesn't really matter once it's passed. It only matters for the 24 hours that the cycle lasts, or even shorter. So today the cycle is much shorter because of the constant updates on news cycles. So this is, I would say, a side introduction, but the question is, should Jews be reading the newspaper today? Today, reading news is very different to what it used to be. There's this debate of being involved at the same time, also being concerned about all the which is connected to it. But I'd like to do something I think even more profound, and that is let's read retroactively how Jews read items of news. I'd like to take three important events throughout the course of Jewish history and see how they are published in the secular world and how they are understood in the Jewish world. And I think this is a very meaningful exercise. Here's how it goes. The first actually takes us back, really, almost 3,000 years ago to a time where the kingdom of Israel and Judea had split. The kingdom of Israel is under attack in the north by the Assyrian Empire as it expands its reach downwards, and finally is exiled in a number of tours, the tour of Tiglath-Pileser III, who is one of the Assyrian emperors, and ultimately leads to one of the crowning princes of the Assyrian Empire, which is Sennacherib. Sennacherib II, who was a very, very powerful individual, conquered most of the Middle East. And we know that he came down and had an encounter not just with Israel, because he exiled Israel, but also the remaining of Israel, but he also came into the land of Judea. And so it is interesting to see how it is reported academically, how it is reported what he did, and the truth is that he reported it himself. Many of these kings were incredibly ostentatious people, and they had a lot to say about themselves, and the part of their legacy they decided to write down. So, so to speak, the newspaper of the time is what Sennacherib wrote about himself. And so it is written on what's called a prism. A prism is one way that it was essentially a... I put a picture over here, the one in the Israel Antiquities Museum in Jerusalem. There's another two which are the same. This one's not as good a shape, but there's another one in London, and I believe another one somewhere else in Europe where it's stored. And essentially it has a number of sides. It's got a number of panels, and on each of the panels is covered with lime, and into the lime is etched in cuneiform. They would use reeds to etch out the writing. And the writing is a very long and sophisticated description of his multiple conquests. You know, he starts off talking about how he's the king of heaven and earth, and all the beasts and the fire all pay submission to him. And, you know, that's usually the sort of the tone of kings in those days. And then he gets to column three, and he talks about Judea. That's where it's relevant to us. So here's what he says. He says, "As for Hezekiah the Jew, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong walled cities, as well as the small cities in the neighborhood, which were without number, by leveling with battering rams, and by bringing up siege engines, by attacking and storming on foot, by mines, tunnels, and breaches, I besieged and took those cities, 200,150 people, great and small, male and female, horses, mules, asses, camels, cattle, sheep, without number. I brought away from them and counted as spoil, himself like a caged bird I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. Earthworks I threw up against him, and the one coming out of the city gate I turned back into his misery. The cities of his, which I despoiled, I cut off from his land, and to the Mitinni, king of Ashdod, Padi, the king of Ekron, and Silibael, the king of Gaza, I gave." So meaning he's talking about how he gave many of the cities that used to be Judean to the enemy, which are the Philistines in the coast. So he redistributed them. "And thus I diminished..." Thank you so much. Thank you, Rosemary. "And thus I diminished his land. I added to the former tribute and laid upon him the giving up of the land, as well as imposts or gifts for my majesty. As for Hezekiah, the terrifying splendor of my majesty overcame him, and the Urbu," that's the Arabs, "and his mercenary troops, which had brought into the strength in Jerusalem, his royal city, deserted him, in addition to 30 talents of gold and 800 talents of silver, gems," and he goes on to describe all things that he had taken from Jerusalem. So sounds like a pretty resounding success, right? So this is Sennacherib's tour of Judea, and it is mostly correct, it seems. In fact, in Tanakh, it corroborates this account. Most of us are not aware of this, but it actually, when you learn Sefer Melachim Beis and Dibrei Hayom and Sefer Yeshayahu, where are three accountings of this particular incident, in fact, it does relate to this. And what is interesting is to focus on the religious perspective of understanding this news. So, as an example, in Source 5, the narrator of Tanakh tells us, that's Yirmiyahu, who's the author of Melachim, says, Uvarba Esrei Shana, the Melech Chizkiah, when Chizkiah was 14 years on the throne, Ola Sancher of Melech Ashur, Al Kol Orei Yehuda HaBetzurois Vayit Pasem. He attacked all the walled cities of Judea, and he captured them, like was described by Sancheriv. So he went to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, and he said, I sinned. Shuv me'alai es asher titein olai eseh. Whatever it is that you want, whatever financial demands you make upon me, I will do. Vayos melech Ashur al Chizkiah melech Yehuda shlosh me'os kikar kesev shloshim kikar zav. 300 silver talents and 30 gold, which is precisely what is described in the prism as to the bounty that was taken from Chizkiah. Vayitan Chizkiah is kol hakesev haninsal beis Hashem u'oizos beis Hamelech, and he emptied the coffers of the king and the beis Hamikdash, because the beis Hamikdash had its own treasury. In fact, cut off the doors of the temple, which were worth an extreme amount of money because of their gold covering, and he sent them to the king of Assyria. So we do see this. In fact, Lachish is central to this whole narrative, because if you read the Assyrian narrative of the conquest of Lachish, it's a terrifying siege. Lachish was built on a hill. Today we don't think about Lachish because it's not a city that we visit per se, but Lachish was one of the large bastions of Judea. And if you read it and you see the terrifying images the Assyrians actually drew in that siege of how they captured it and how many Jews they killed in this time, it's a pretty significant, terrifying thing, which is why Chizkiah bid for peace at Lachish. That's where Assyria is. They're just outside Jerusalem, and they're waiting to enter. However, yes, John?
Usually in the news sometimes, there is a news item which you're telling us, and then I'm right to the directly on the side. It says news analysis, and somebody comes along and gives some perspective. And apropos also from this past week's Parsha, where we talk about naming a king. Is there any record of the relationship in this particular instance between Hezekiah and the Sanhedrin or the Levium or whoever was there? Because that's the money that's supposed to be for the Beis Hamikdash. You're taking the guts out of giving.
Yeah.
Sacrifices.
Yeah, so I just give me a little bit of space and I'll have a chance to do this. The Mishnah talks about this, and the Mishnah describes that the rabbis approved and disapproved of some of the actions that Chizkiah took. Last week we looked a little bit about at Chizkiah's title, which he dug in anticipation of the siege of Jerusalem. And the rabbis disapproved of that, or some of the rabbis disapproved of that, as you saw, that was Rabbi Nosson indicates that some did approve. And cutting off the walls, the doors of the temple was another disapproved action as well. This is seen as not an appropriate thing. So that was the way the rabbi stands. You say, but the main commentator, we'll call the main analysis of the time, is actually done by, in those days, we were fortunate not just to have rabbis, but prophets. And so in this case, it's actually helpful to say, what does the prophet say? The answer is, well, we have it. Because who is the prophet? It's his father-in-law. Who's his father-in-law? Yeshayahu. Okay, so his father Yeshayahu is around at the time, and so that conversation is very important, which is the next thing. So now this is where, meaning to say, what's first of it, before we get any further, it's just interesting to see that Sancheriv's synod matches up almost directly to the narrative in Tanakh, which is just fascinating to see. They're telling the same story. But what is interesting is that Sancheriv is not 100% honest with us, right? And the reason he's not honest is because although he describes shutting up Chizkiah in Yerushalayim, he does not describe the end of the story, which is why it's also important to remember in a news cycle, what isn't said is also a glaring, we'll call it, the omission is also, in a certain sense, a falsehood, because it's not really giving the full story. But nonetheless, how does Chizkiah view this episode? This is what's important. How does Chizkiah view this episode? How does he interact with this spiritually, religiously? So we're told in Source 6, it's the next parak in Melachim Beis, which is Perak Yotes, Vayispalel Chizkiah lifnei Hashem, Vayomer. So he prays to Hashem and he says, Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Hashem God of Israel, Yosheva Kruvim, who sits with, among the angels, Atahu Elokim Levadecha, you created the heavens and the earth. Hatei Hashem oznecha ushma. Tilt your ear to hear. Pekach Hashem enecha re'ei. Open your eyes, so to speak, and see. Ushma es divrei sancheri asher shlocho lecharev elokim chai. Listen to the curses he thrusts upon Israel, the living God. Okay, remember that the way it has worked is up till now is he has sent one of his generals called Rav Shakei, who we have a tradition was a was a turncoat Jew himself. And he gets out there and he starts cursing Chizkiyah. He starts cursing Hashem. And he says, we've destroyed every other kingdom and have their gods helped. Your God's not going to help either. And he starts doing this. So Chizkiyah says, Hashem, listen to this person. Listen to this terrible person. In fact, the courtiers of Chizkiyah said to Rav Shakei, stop talking Hebrew, right? And he says, I'm going to continue speaking Hebrew because I want your people to hear. Right, so it's a terrible thing. So Hezekiah says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, can you stomach that? Can you listen to this nonsense? Omnam Hashem hechrivu malchei Ashur es hagoyim v'sartzom. The kings of Syria have destroyed. Meaning, what he's saying is true. He has destroyed everything in his path. V'nosnu es eloi heihem bo'esh. Ki loi Elohim heimo. Yes, he destroyed all the other kings. You know why? Because they aren't kings, they aren't gods. They don't have power. So when he came to the Moabites and when he came to the kingdom of Aram, the reason he destroyed them was because their gods were useless. That's why he succeeded. Hashem, our God, the power of the world. Let him know that you are the only power in the world. That's what Hezekiah essentially is saying. And this is it seems to be after he has sent the homage, after he has pushed off the lion for just a little bit. Now the Sanherib now encircles Jerusalem, and the siege is now surrounding the small city of Jerusalem. And this is the prayer that he offers. No longer a prayer of appeasement to Sanherib, but now a prayer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And at this point in time, Vayishalach Yeshayahu ben Amoitz el Chizkiyah, Yechizkiyahu le'mor, Komar Hashem lakei Yisrael, Asher ishbalalta elai el Sanherib melech Ashur shamati. Son of Yeshayahu says, your prayer has been heard. It goes on to a long description of what Hashem is going to do to Sancheriv. Very powerful description about how he's going to destroy Sancheriv. And then he gives a sign about the crops of the next year, which are going to indicate that this is going to be, in fact, the way it's going to come out. And skipping to the bottom of page 6, Pasuk Lam Aleph, Kimin Shalim Teitzei She'iris Upleitas Mehar Tzion Kinas Hashem Tzvakois Ta'aseh Zois. There are going to be a remnant from the high mount of Zion. Now remember, 90% of all the cities in all of Judea have been conquered and laid waste, like the rest of the Middle East under Sancheriv. So what he's saying is Jerusalem will be the exception to all of this. And then he goes on, Lochein, on top of page 7, Lochein koyamar Hashem, el melech Ashur, lo yavoy el ha'ir hazois, v'lo yaresh sham chetz, v'lo yakadmenu mogen, v'lo yishpoch alei asoy lelo. There is not going to be a arrow fired to Jerusalem, no shots. There will be no shields brought to it, and there will be no solala. What's a solala? They translate over here as a mound. Why a mound? That's that they created the mounds in order to bring up the siege instruments. If you read the attack on Lachish, how they conquered Lachish up a hill, they made a large mound up it. So Yeshayahu is saying there will be no mounds drawn up against Jerusalem. Right? This is all very much the military of the day that he's talking about. Baderech asher yavoy bo yashuv, the way that the Assyrians came, they will return upon. Ve'ela ira zois lo yavoy nu'um Hashem, they will not come to the city. Ve'ganoizis ira zois lo yishia lamani, laman David avdi, I'm going to save the city because of me, Hashem says, and David. Ve'yehi ba'alai la'ahu v'yetzei malach Hashem v'yach ba'amachanei Ashur 185,000. 185,000 soldiers surrounding Jerusalem were killed that night. Ve'yashkimu ba'boike v'yinei kulam pe'gorim eisin, they were all corpses. Vayisa, Vayelech, Vayoshav, Sancheri Melech Ashur, Vayeshav, Ninveh. He returned to his capital, Ninveh. Vayihu Mishtachaveh, Beis Nisroich Elohov, Vaadar Melech, Vashar Etzer, Bonov, Yiko, Bachere, Vahema Nimlatu, Eretz Ararat. So his children killed him on his return. A lot of interesting discussion as to why they killed him. Not for now, fascinating topic. But nonetheless, he left. Clearly emasculated, did not succeed in making this a successful tour finally, and left Jerusalem. Notice, it just comes back to the newspapers and the truth, is that does Sancheriv lie about his lack of conquest of Jerusalem? Does he lie about it? Well, not exactly. He just doesn't describe it. Meaning, if you were not successful as a king and you needed to write your history, the annals of histories, you can't write the wrong thing because somebody's going to catch you out. But what do? You say everything up to it. Right? I locked him in his city and I made him pay lots of money. Right? So the money was paid beforehand. The locking in the city is true. But the next step he didn't describe, which is the fact that he did not succeed in conquering Jerusalem. It was his failure of conquest, and that was the end of his tour, returning to his country to be killed. So first thing, just important in terms of reading the news, is you need to read the whole story, right? And the news usually only puts in what, that which is of interest to the person who has the agenda or the publisher of the news. In this case, the prism needs to look fully successful, which it does look like if you are not to realize this fact. But more than that is understanding that whatever understanding it was, the reason why I didn't reach it, Judaism is explaining it was because of that prayer of Chizkiyahu HaMelech and because of that assurance of a Ganoisius or Irazois by Yeshayahu that there was success. No matter what or how Sancheriv would have explained to his people coming back home, and yes, all the gold he had, but not being able to succeed in this, that is the true understanding, which is oftentimes missing because no newspaper or no, we'll call it secular commentator would ever throw in that perspective of this being the case. Similarly, and perhaps I think even more powerfully, if we fast forward a number of centuries after the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, after essentially 52 years of exile in Babylon, there is now a change of empire and the Babylonians are destroyed, overthrown very, very quickly by the Chaldeans and the Persians. The Persians take over, and in that quick succession, we have a new and very, very powerful empire, which takes power. This is under, at this point in time, well, there are a number of emperors, but the one is a person by the name of Cyrus the Great. Generally speaking, it seems to be in history, you get the great if you kill a lot of people. So, like Alexander seemed to have that as well. So Cyrus is a very, very powerful king. In fact, it's worthwhile looking at the Achaemenid dynasty, which is under Cyrus the Great. I put a map in on page 8 over here. You know, when you read Megillas Esther and you say, "Me hoidu ad Kush," it's hard to appreciate that until you actually see the map. Hoidu is India. That's on the right-hand side. Kush is Ethiopia down in Africa. Right? So it's spanning three continents, right? Asia, Europe, and Africa. That's how far the Persian Empire reached at this point in time. And what was interesting about Cyrus was Cyrus had a different foreign policy than the Babylonians. The Babylonians were a ruthless people. They came in and they killed everybody they met. There was no white flags flown from the windows when it came to the Babylonian foreign policy. And they rose extremely fast and fell extremely fast. Very terrifying empire, and the cruelty which was talked about under the Babylonians. Just if you look, even if you just read Sefer Daniel, you know, just like on a whim, when nobody's able to guess the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, he slaughters all his advisors. I mean, he was a very, very cruel person, and the short-lived Babylonian dynasty was very cruel as well. It was taken after a number of assassinations over by the Persians. And one of the things they changed was they realized that if you want to govern so many states, at the times of Esther, we talk about 127 independent states, right? That means to say that these are countries that were conquered by the empire, under the empire. So how do you control them? So the Persian policy was different to that of Babylonia. And this is what he says on the Cyrus cylinder, which is in the British Museum. It's a little small, as you can see. But here is written the annals of Cyrus. And he says the following. From Susa, Agada, Esuna, Zamam, Metura, Dere, and as far as the region of Gutiam, the sacred centers of the other side of the Tigris, whose sanctuaries have been abandoned for a long time, I returned the images of the gods who resided there to their places, and I let them dwell in eternal abodes. I gathered all their inhabitants and returned them to their dwellings. In addition, at the command of Marduk, the great lord, right, that's the Persian deity, I settled in their habitations in pleasing abodes the gods of Sumer, Akkad, whom Nabonidus, in the anger of the lords of the gods, had brought into Babylon. Nabonidus was one of the Babylonian kings. Okay, so just understanding what was happening. The Assyrians and the Babylonians in general were concerned about the rise of nationalism, right? So the Assyrians particularly, their foreign policy before the Babylonians was to switch people around. So what do they do? is that they exiled Israel, right? Israel. And what they did was they exiled them to various locations. That was the exile of the 10 tribes. Some argue perhaps Ethiopia and India and all these different places. And then they brought in other nationals into that area. Why? Is because you don't want to have a rebellion. If you have a rebellion, people are going to fight for their land. So you don't want them to be in their land to fight for it, because that's the problem with nationalism. So that was the Assyrian foreign policy. The Babylonian foreign policy was to conquer everybody, destroy all the temples, bring all their idols to the capital in Babylon. That was their policy. It was more of a almost like scorched earth policy. So what Cyrus says is that in order to make this all work, I'm very happy to return everybody to their places. Let them have their gods. Let them have their places. So you say, well, how does he keep in check? So the Persians were very successful at incredible systems of communication and espionage. So they had soldiers in all of their states, and they had a very careful tax system. They had reporters. They had informers on the ground in every place. And if there was a rebellion, they would squash the rebellion. But they allowed each nationality to thrive in its place with its gods. Okay. You know why that's good for us? Because the Jews were one of the beneficiaries of that policy. So therefore, when it came down to time that the Jews came to Cyrus and they asked for the return to Judea, he said, with pleasure. And he wrote them a letter and he let them build the second Beis Hamikdash as an expression of how he treated the rest of these folks in the cylinder, right? That was his foreign policy. And so you want to succeed? Go for it. Build your temple. When he received letters from the locals saying that they're attacking, then he stopped it. And then it was started again 18 years later. But the point is that he had inherently there was no issue with the Jews building their temple and resettling their place, which is why there were multiple tiers. There were three different aliyahs of Jews back from the Babylon-Persian area back into Israel. So that's fascinating. If you're learning world history, it would be very fascinating to study and understand the difference in foreign policy of Cyrus versus, let's say, Nebuchadnezzar, versus Sennacherib, versus Tiglath-Pileser III. But we're not studying world history. We're studying the way that we read world history. And therefore, we need to understand how to read it. And that's why we read the first pasuk in Sefer Ezra. First pasuk in Sefer Ezra is, V'shas achas Koresh, Melech Pras, in the first year of Koresh, that's the Hebrew name for Cyrus, L'chlois Tevar Hashem Mipir Yirmiyahu, who after the word of Yirmiyahu had finished from Hashem, Ha'ir Hashem es Ruach Koresh Melech Pras. God illuminated the eyes of the spirit of Cyrus the Great. Vayaver kol b'chol malchusoy v'gam b'chum nichtav le'mor. He wrote this letter, and the letter is, the Jews may return. So here's a very fascinating way of reading history. God illuminated his spirit. God awakened his spirit. What does that mean precisely? So the Ralbag says, interestingly enough, he says, actively. Listen to the way he describes it in Source 9. Vayir Hashem Ruach Koresh yidmeh. Shehera Hashem Yisparach b'chalom laKoresh zeh ha'inyanu boit tzivo livnois beis Yerushalayim beis Yerushalayim Hashem Yehuda. So he had a dream, and God instructed him in the dream to build the Beis Hamikdash again. That's a very active involvement. That's according to the Ralbag.
The Ralbag is usually more of a literalist.
Exactly. The Ralbag, right? Now the Ralbag is more of a rationalist in general. But here he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to him in a dream, and that's what it means. Now that's a very active form. I think that perhaps it might be more subtle than that's what Rashi says. Rashi says one word. Rashi only says is, but Ratzon, his will. Which means to say, what is Rashi saying? Such a powerful idea.
Is
HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan in the world. Hashem has a destination where history is supposed to be getting. And he has many messengers, and he has many ways of doing that. And he decided to allow, to so to speak, cultivate the idea of Cyrus's foreign policy, which would be to the benefit of the Jewish history, the ultimate goal, which is the rebuilding the second Beis Hamikdash. He wanted the second Beis Hamikdash to come to be. So what did he do? He found somebody who would be able to do that. And if you ask Cyrus, and you put Cyrus on News 12, and you say, Cyrus, tell us now over here, O emperor, O liege, what is it that brings you to this? He would tell you a number of reasons. He would say it's better because there's less rebellions. People are happier in general. They pay bigger taxes when they're in the national. He'll tell you all those reasons. And Ezra tells us as a prophet, I'll tell you the real reason. It's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed that idea to be cultivated. That's the way to read history. It's very subtle. In fact, I remember Rabbi Sacks talks about this in the Great Partnership. He has such a beautiful observation. He talks about how when Yosef goes down in Parshas Vayeshev to find his brothers in Dotan, and he looks for them in Shechem, and he doesn't find them, and he's to'e basadeh, he's wayward, and he finds this ish, and this man says, I saw that they were actually by Dotan, and then he goes on, so he asks, who is that man? And one of the comments, the Ramban says, he wasn't anybody, he was a gas station attendant, right? Meaning to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can use for the tools of the machinations of Jewish history, he can use a regular person who's giving regular directions to be that instrumental turning point in Jewish history. That Yosef will find his brothers, be sold, become the heir king of the vizier of Egypt, and go on beyond that way. The way of looking at history is understanding that many rational pieces come together to form a larger edifice. It's a very, very profound way of looking at history. Rabbi Sacks is talking about that in terms of evolution. How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu affect creation? Is HaKadosh Baruch Hu do a snap and in one moment everything comes into being? Or is there more complex systems that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into place which slowly evolve into his reality? Now let's fast forward into the 20th century. A very important observation which happens. There was in 1916, during the course of World War I, while millions and millions of people are dying in trenches in Western Europe, the British and the French, knowing that they are going to win the war on the Allied side and the Western European side, decide to draw up the Sykes-Picot agreement, which is laid out. And essentially, remember, one of the reasons for the World War I, one of the causes of World War I, was a failing Ottoman Empire. And colonialists were looking in and seeing all the territory that the Ottoman Empire controlled, and they were looking to get it, and that's exactly what happened. So very arrogantly, these colonialists looked in and said, we want the Middle East. And so they divided up the Middle East, and this is what they did. So in 1916, there's a plan on page 9 where they divide up the whole area, what today is Iraq, was an Arab state under British protection. Kuwait was a British rule. The area of Syria and Lebanon came under French rule. That's why still today, if you go to Beirut, right, the language which is spoken is French, right? It became a French mandate, and they divided up essentially the whole of the Middle East. What was fascinating was, what about the area called Palestine, right? So what do you do with this area? And at this point in time, they already had two major waves of Aliyah. They had two major waves of Aliyah going into the third. Now, from Europe, many Jews leaving the pale of Russia, of settlement, in the 1890s. And then again in the 1900s, again, many, many Jews coming over because of persecution, because of idealism, because of Zionism. There were so many reasons as to why Jews were moving in. And the community was swelling. Industry was growing. Many Arabs were moving in from Egypt and Syria because of the job opportunities. They later called themselves Palestinians. But there were lots of people coming into the land, the land of Israel. At which time there was an appeal made to the British government, who was to be taking over the area of Palestine, and a statement was issued by Lord Balfour. This is what's called the Balfour Declaration in 1917. While on November 2nd, which is while the war was actually still going on, and he sends a letter to Lord Rothschild. I have the pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with the Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. Here's the quotation: His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment of Palestine as a I can't read that word, the national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country, which was the case. I should be grateful if you will bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation, signed by Lord Balfour. And this is a very powerful statement. Give me a few moments. In which the British government essentially recognized the fact that although there happened to be, you know, incredible swaths of land where the Arabs could live, there was only one place that the Jews were going to, and it was a very small area, and they would try to help cultivate under their control the area as a Jewish homeland, not interfering with the rest of the area around them. Now, it is complex. It was deeply complex, and perhaps if you'd ask the British 20 years later, they would have regretted having made this decision, because it came with its complexities. There were riots, the Arabs rioted in 1920, they rioted all the way through the 1920s, in fact. They rioted through the 1930s. In 1928, a number of Jews put up a mechitza on Yom Kippur at the Kotel, and because there was more Jews, and so they wanted to daven separately. Before, they didn't have the facility to do that under the Ottomans, and when they put that up, then the Arabs declared that the Jews were trying to take over Al-Aqsa, and they rioted in the streets, killing many Jews, and this culminated in the massacre in 1929, when many Jews in Jerusalem, and mostly in Hebron, were killed. That was because of that mechitza, which was placed in the Har HaBayis. The only difference between then and now is that then the police forces at the time didn't do anything. And so the Jews were massacred without reprieve until the next day when the British lethargically stepped in and tried to help pick up the bodies. Today, thank God, we do have... We do have a police force that can at least prevent the massacres that would happen if it were not to be the case, if somebody else was in charge. But Bir Zemei, and that led to the Peel Commission and led to the White Paper, in which the British then stopped the access of Jews to the land, limited the quota of the Jews in pandering to the road of the Arabs. In 1929, they issued a commission of inquiry in which they declared that the Western Wall was actually Arab, and that's why the Jews were not able to blow the shofar at the Kotel for the rest of the duration of the British mandate. So it was a complex history. But nonetheless, so it was a very difficult time. And even in 1948, up to the point that the British left, when the old city was already under siege by Arab irregulars and the encroaching Arab Legion of Jordan, and there was no food going in and out, the British were there, and in their stance of neutrality, would not allow Jews in to help resupply the city because they were neutral. So the British were not our best friends when it came down to this. But nonetheless, all that aside, and all the complexities that followed aside, it is worthwhile noting the reaction of many of the great sages of the time. So as an example, the Chafetz Chaim's grandson quotes the following. This is actually written in an essay published in 1977 by Rav Nachum Kasher called Das Torah al Shvur Shalo Yalalu B'Chomer, in a journal called Shana B'Shana. Very beautiful essay. It's really worthwhile reading. It's actually available for free online at .ac.il, where he describes the following. He says, "Kishashomar Asaba Kadisha Rabbi Yisrael Mera Kohen Bala Chovetz Chaim Es HaBesora Shel Hatzaras Balfour." When the Chovetz Chaim heard about this, remember the Chovetz Chaim is still around in 1917. He was able to appreciate this. What did he say? Ra Kein Isarusa De La Ela Isarusa De La Mala. He saw a movement. This is a Kabbalistic term for a shift in the downward in the world called he saw a shift in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of handling the world, that somehow he had allowed this moment, this ability of protection to happen. Be'inyana Geula v'kiva, and he hoped ki yigia eis ratzon, that this was a time of divine will. Rak chashash shema hadarois yakalkalu. He was concerned that perhaps people would not be worthy enough to see the end of this moment, this window. Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, the Rav of Yerushalayim, was a very, very respected individual. I actually happened to be close to his kever just a couple weeks ago on Har HaZeisim, where he says the following. Listen to this beautiful description. He says, Naniach, let's assume, she'alafim shana, she'alpaim shana loy ra'ah geshem. You haven't had rain for 2,000 years. Ulepeta, and suddenly, Nira Anan Kal Bashamayim. Now you see a light cloud in the heaven. Surely people would say, despite everything else, there's hope. This is a cloud. Maybe it means rain. Are we not going to look at the declaration issued by Balfour to Lord Rothschild as at least a little cloud in the sky? You're going to miss this moment and think that there's no significance in this. Now, Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was not a Zionist by any stretch of the imagination. When the Zionists came in 1916 and 1918 to try to work out a schooling situation with the Rabbonim of Yerushalayim and the new Zionists, they completely desisted, removed themselves from any form of state or government mandated education. Till this day, there's no English taught in the schools that were under from eighth grade onwards in their schools under this leadership. Just understand this. But nonetheless, you have to understand what you read the newspaper, how to read the newspaper. Said Rav Rosenfeld. The Mishnah Chochma, Rav Meir Simcha Devinsk, living in Europe at the time. When seeing this, describes this. This statement is very, very famous because he's addressing a halachic issue, which is the Shalosh Shavuos, the three oaths in the Maseches Ksubos, which prevent the Jews from one of them preventing the Jews from coming up Bechoma. He says in the center of this, without reading the whole thing, he says now, however, in the middle of this whole paragraph, now, however, the Divine Providence has brought together the League of Nations of Intelligent Nations in San Remo. I wonder if you'd say the same thing 20 years later. But in San Remo, a dictate was established that the land of Israel shall be for the Jewish people. Since the fear of the oaths has been removed with the permission of the nations, the mitzvah settling the land of Israel arises, a mitzvah equal to that of all other precepts of the Torah, and this mitzvah returns to its place. It is a mitzvah on everyone to help with the power, with all of their power to observe this mitzvah. And if Hashem, may His name be blessed, will allow this to come about, and if the matter will increase and expand, this will surely, then surely it is a matter which stands at the zenith of the universe. So he understands that really, by the fact that the nations all get together and voted, because the Balfour Declaration was the beginning, when the League of Nations was formed, they voted in San Remo and declared that the land of Palestine, or the Mandate of Palestine, would be a Jewish homeland. Once that was voted on, he says, clearly the nations of the world are allowing the Jews back. Once they allow the Jews back, the shvur goes away, and now it's a mitzvah for everybody else to come in. Very beautiful way of witnessing this. Rav Kook says in similar terms, it's just for the sake of time right now, it's hard to read because in Orat it's incredibly impenetrable, but it's worthwhile trying to appreciate his observation in Orat over here on the 14th page about the return of Jews to the political sphere. How there was a time where we desisted getting involved in politics, and now this is the time to get involved in politics again, because we saw this as a moment of opportunity. I'd like to stop here and just think about this for a second. Three major events, right? So the tour of Sancheriv of the Middle East, Cyrus's foreign policy, and the Balfour Declaration. These are all items which were reported by the entity, by the foreign government, relating to the land of Israel, and how we looked at them, and how we look again perspective about them. What is fascinating is that I didn't put in anything that was in the last century. Notice that the Balfour Declaration is 1917, and part of the reason for that is the following, and it comes down to I think a profound thought of Rav Kook, and I'd like to learn that together, if that's all right with you. Okay, this is a very profound observation that Rav Kook has in a sefer called Orot HaKodesh. Or a Sakharish in the second Chalek. And I think this to me is the key of reading the news, and we'll close with this. Here's what he says. Kesha Ahava Yoredes Me'olam Ha'atzilus La'olam Ha'briya. When Hashem's, this is on the last page in page 12. When Hashem's love will descend from the world of Atzilus, in Kabbalistic terms, this is a
emanation.
Thank you. There are four distinct worlds, the highest being Atzilus, Atzilus, Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya. So from the highest world, the world of emanation, where this is beyond words, when Hashem's love, when Hashem's energy moves from that world into this tangible world of ours, he already is partuseho liprate pratim. It becomes more detailed and granular as it descends into this world. Le nigudim vestiros, into contradictions and disagreements. Veretzorech shel tzimtzum umiut erech ava. And it's a necessary process in order for that love of Hashem, that energy of Hashem, to be expressed in this world. Lo chol prat miyuchad b'shril prat acher, lipratim arbim b'shril acherim arbim. So it makes space for all the details, and those details seem at odds with each other. Lipratim michlal mipnei klal yosayim ha-kholeles as well. Now, here's our job. This is actually a few paragraphs later, but let's put it in here. Mishoykei ava alalu, k'shehem ro'im ha'olam b'yichud, ha'chai molei kantorios, Avos redivos unigudim. When a person looks at this world and he sees all the persecution, all the difficulties, the arguments, all the unfixable reality around us, miad heim orgim liyos mishtatfim b'chol chayim b'shiifos habiviyos es haklalas hachayim v'ichudam. A person who's really trying to find the love of God will see all these details and try to find a way to unite them, try to see a way that they are all coming back, seeing them as emanations from a higher form. He says, "Shleimim v'shalvosam, hey margishim v'yodim." These people know, "Shekirvas elokim shem orgim oleo B'malei nishmosam hi moivila oisam rak lihisachdusam imaklal uba'ad haklal. That a person who really desires to come close to Hashem realizes that everything that comes into this world in all its complexity and its diffusion is really part of the large expression of Hashem's oneness in this world. K'shem boim l'shidros ha'adam u'motzim p'palgus shalamim datot k'akitot shifot minugadim. And you see different nations, you see different groups, you see different religions, all of them at odds with each other. Hem yis'amtzim b'chol kochom l'achlil es hakol. We try, such people who try to find the love of God are trying to see how it all is part of God's picture. U'l'acheid And so, the part of the issue over here is like this, is that the reason why it's hard to look at items in the last 100 years and sort of definitively say that this is the subtle perspective of Hashem weaving his way into history is for a very simple reason, is it takes perspective. It takes time and perspective. And there are very few people who have that bigger picture of being able to see the larger energy in the world all coming together, who can say it at the time, time today than there ever was. We live in a world of complex, fragmented detail, and the leaders are fragmented, and it's a generation of details. There are few people like Rav Kook, as an example, like the Chavetz Chaim Rav Zonnefeld, who can say that there's something afoot, something is moving here, because today, if anybody would say that it would be criticized. How do you know? Who are you to say? What breadth of perspective do you have to be able to do that? We need time in order to be able to look back and have a little bit of a sense that there is something afoot, that history is being written, that the next book of Nach is being written, and hopefully we will have a footnote in it. Maybe there's something that we can do to advance the cause of Jewish history. Maybe there's something we can do to advance the cause of world history. But it's subtle, it's complex, it's detail-oriented. And I think that the observation of Rav Kook is that in reading history, the way Jews read history is to understand that there's a larger picture, there's a larger message afoot, and hopefully seeing the achdus, the ichud of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in the complexity of detail as we see it. That's our challenge. I hope that we are up to it. Be'ezrat Hashem. Thank you so much, everybody, for taking this.